KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture, and thank you for spending your time listening to KZSU. Today I'm very excited to have on Professor Jackie Lipton from my alma mater, Case Western Reserve University School of Law. Jackie is working on a book entitled Global Real Property, Internet Domain Names, Trademark, and Free Speech, that will be published by Edward Elgar Publishers in the first half of next year. We have spent some time on Hearsay Culture discussing trademark issues and also domain names with a few previous guests, including Eric Goldman from Santa Clara Law School. But today we're going to take a more detailed focus on the issue of domain name litigation. Domain names, as anyone that surfs the internet may be aware, although they may not know that they're called this, are literally the names of websites, and these website names mask internet protocol addresses that allow you to surf to any page on the internet that you can type into a web browser. Jackie is taking a very detailed look, based upon several previous articles that she's written in this area, on the issue of how domain name disputes arise and in what context, and then how we deal with those conflicts. In reading Jackie's work, I learned quite a bit, and among other things, I didn't realize, in fact, how many different ways that domain name disputes come up, and we're going to talk about them a bit. But Jackie's contribution here is not only to describe these various problems, but offer a variety of interesting remedies that may get to solving these issues in a more expeditious way, and ultimately in a way that's more fair and reflects more accurately the values that are inherent not only in the internet, but also in how we operate businesses. So we're going to be talking today with Jackie about domain names, about trademark law, and about some of the speech issues involved. By way of very brief background, Professor Jackie Lipton is not only a professor at Case Western Law School, but also the co-director of the Law Technology and Arts Center. When I was at Case Western as a law student back in the mid-90s, the intellectual property program was not as developed as it is today, and Case laudably has put together a very impressive group of scholars in this area and a program that makes me wish that that program existed when I was there. But I'm very happy that Case has moved in this direction, and I'm proud of my alma mater. And with all of that, I'm very excited to have on Professor Jackie Lipton. So, Jackie, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's start off with, I gave a very brief introduction of what the topic is, but for those listeners that are not as technologically knowledgeable about how the internet operates, I'm gonna ask you for a more detailed, if there is one, explanation of what is a domain name.
Well, a domain name is basically what you see when you are on the web. It's in the what we call the URL bar, the Uniform Resource Locator bar at the top of any web page in a web browser like Netscape or Internet Explorer or Mozilla Firefox. And basically that came about because initially, and in fact this is still the case, computers find each other. They find an internet address using strings of numbers. So every web page on the internet has what we call an IP address, an internet protocol address, and that's a string of nine numbers. But of course, human beings don't remember nine numbers. That's why we have telephone directories for telephone numbers that we don't remember. But we didn't develop the domain name system the way we developed the telephone system. So instead of having a directory of who owns what number, the designers of the system came up with alphanumeric, easily remembered mnemonic names that would then resolve to the IP address of the web page, so that if you wanted to go to McDonald's website, it would be fairly intuitive to guess that it's probably McDonald's.com, and you can type that into a URL bar or a search engine like Google, and the computers can then find you the location you want. They then translate the name into the nine-digit number and take you to the web page that you're looking for.
I should mention that you're joining us by telephone from Cleveland, Ohio, and that we're recording this show on October 7th. I always ask authors and people that focus in different areas this background question, which is literally, how did you become interested in trademark law broadly and in domain name issues specifically? Because as I mentioned in the introduction, this book is the culmination and an addition to several articles you've written in this area. So where did the interest come from?
Well, actually, the interest in domain names predated the interest in, or indeed any knowledge of, trademark law.
Hmm.
When I started out my academic career in Australia, your listeners will notice, I'm sure, that I have a bit of an accent going here.
Right.
I was, in fact, a banking and finance lawyer, and one of the things that I was doing in practice and then in early academia in Australia was a lot of secured finance practice involving intangible property. And that was at about the time the domain name system was coming into being in the early to mid-1990s. So I did some work very early on about securitizing domain names, the extent to which you could use an internet domain name as collateral for a loan. And that led me to be very interested in basically how the system worked in general, what a domain name was, is it the same as a trademark, is it something else, is it a different kind of intangible property, because obviously if you're a finance lawyer, you need to take security over something that is a property interest, and so we had to work out how to characterize a domain name in order to do commercial transactions involving domain names. Later on, when I went to Cambridge in the UK and later when I came to the States, I trained in intellectual property law and I started teaching and writing about cyber law. And while I was teaching the cyber law course, I again became interested in domain names because at that point there were by then a lot of decided cases about domain name trademark disputes. So at that point I learned a bit more about the trademark law, the intersection between trademarks and domain names. And then that led me to think about the other kinds of disputes that arise in the domain name space where perhaps a trademark isn't involved or is involved alongside some other interest that perhaps should also be protected by the legal system.
The nature of the internet is something that we've often talked about on Hearsay Culture, and I guess I want to ask you this somewhat abstract question, but how does the domain name itself and the system of domain names you mentioned a little serve the interests of those who are surfing the net, and then more specifically, how do domain names fit into the larger guiding principles of the internet being a source of free flow of information and an architecture that anyone can access?
Well, I think that's an interesting question, and I think the answer probably changes as the internet evolves. So I think very early on, before we had electronic commerce, people didn't really assume that domain names were anything particularly special. It was a handy way of finding a website. It wasn't aimed at big commercial corporations. It was aimed at universities and researchers who were looking for each other online. So it was just regarded as, here's just an easy way to find the person or the research facility that you're looking for. Around the time that people became aware that, wow, you could use the internet for electronic commerce, that was when all of the trademark disputes started, because obviously the domain name then becomes the obvious label for a company to host its own web presence and its e-commerce website. And then very quickly after that, people want to use domain names for all sorts of things. They want to use domain names to criticize trademark holders. They want to use domain names that reflect their own personal names or their personal interests. They want to use domain names to talk about, for example, an actor or an actress or a singer that they really like. So they want to use that person's name in the domain name to indicate who they want to talk about on their website. And again, you know, if you go back to the beginning of the system, the domain name was really the obvious search tool because there weren't sophisticated search engines back in the 1990s. As search engines have become more sophisticated, domain names are arguably less relevant as a search tool in and of itself because you can type McDonald's or Nike or Case Western into your Google search or Microsoft Bing or whatever search engine you're using, and it will probably take you to what you want. But I don't think that means that domain names are no longer important in the search process, because search engine algorithms do prioritize domain names in their search function. So I think domain names are not really losing their importance, although they're often used in a different way.
You anticipate an area that we will talk about in a little while, which is the relationship between domain names and search engines and that development. But before we get to that, I do think that it's important to have this core understanding. So if a domain name is the way by which one can access a page, then my follow-up question is, how does one get a domain name? Could you describe that process for us?
Yeah, you get a domain name by applying to one of the many domain name registrars to register the name. And initially, there were only a handful of registrars for generic top-level domains, or GTLDs, which are the ones like .com, .net, and .org. And there's usually one relevant domain name domain registrar for a country code domain, like a CCTLD in each relevant country. That was deregulated some years ago, so now there are really a lot of domain name registrars, and there's a lot of competition amongst the registrars for low pricing and for adding additional services like web hosting along with the domain name registration. But what you do is you basically go to one of those companies' websites, you type in the domain name you want, they tell you if it's available or not. If it's not available, they give you some other options that may be similar. So if I wanted Lipton.com and that wasn't available, I'd probably get a bunch of suggestions like Lipton.net, Lipton.org, Lipton.co.us. Do I want one of those names? Some of the registrars will also give you a service that will let you know if the name you want becomes deregistered later on. Some have auctions for names that are about to expire. But basically, when you register, you get a fixed term of years. It can be 1 year, 5 years, whatever the registrar is offering, and the pricing will vary depending on A, how many years you want, and B, what other services you might take from them along with the name. And then you can go ahead, sign your registration contract in which you agree that you're not, to your knowledge, infringing other people's rights, and you go ahead, set up your website, and use the name.
And then when you go to one of these sites, in order to actually make the domain name functional, and I'm not asking for a detailed computer engineering explanation here, but what steps have to be taken by the registrar to get this done?
Well, the registrars are all hooked into a central database, so only one person can hold one domain name at a time, hence why I title the book Global Real Estate or Global Real Property, because unlike much intellectual property, these are truly rivalrous assets in the sense that only one person can own the thing at the same time. So there is a centralized registry, and I'm not a techie person, so I'm probably fluffing this up a little bit, and you don't see it. As the registrant, you don't see any of what goes on, but the registrar is able to direct the alphanumeric name that you want to the IP address that you've provided, and then make sure that no one else can access that particular name. And then if later on someone else wants the name and you agree and there's a transfer, what a transfer would actually be is a deregistration to you at re-registration under the same process by the registrar to whoever the new entity is that's going to own the name.
Got it. Yeah, my purpose in asking the question, although the technology might be interesting, is to get a sense of the entities involved in actually getting a domain name and therefore a website up and running. And so I think I've covered that well. One last background question before we get into the focus of the book that you're working on is I think reflected in what you just said. The domain name system is international in scope, and it involves an organization called ICANN. And so we're going to be talking about ICANN, I think, quite a bit in our discussion. What is ICANN, and how does it relate to this issue?
Well, ICANN is the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, and they are technically a private entity that has been given responsibility. They have a memorandum of understanding with the US government that is actually being re-looked at now. It's about to expire. But they basically are responsible for the top-level domains like .com, .net and .org. They are also at the moment in process of opening up a whole new bunch of generic top-level domains. They technically do not have any authority jurisdiction to administer or manage the country code top-level domains, although they have a good dialogue with the entities in the different countries that do manage those names. And the interesting thing about ICANN in this context is that they are very clearly, under their bylaws, a technical organisation. They are responsible for managing, administering the generic level domains and for authorising registrars to allow people to register the names, and they run a dispute resolution mechanism now as well. But they are not a law and policy-making body. And to the extent that they are entitled to make law and policy under their bylaws, it has to be peripheral to their technical and administrative functions for the system. They're not entitled to make global policy. And that's been a sticking point for them, because it's very, very difficult to administer this incredibly popular, incredibly valuable system with so many competing stakeholders without really having the authority to make policy decisions, but they also don't have the manpower or the expertise to make those decisions because they weren't set up to do that.
We are talking with Professor Jackie Lipton of Case Western Reserve University School of Law here on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. With that background, Jackie, we can talk a bit about your book. And you made reference to the title that you have, and I want to discuss in more detail. When we talk about real property, and you're talking about global real property, what is the nexus between the subtitle, between domain names, trademark, and free speech? Where do they come together? And how does that nexus a focus of your book?
Well, what I was trying to get at in the title is two things, really. One is that there's always an interplay in any domestic legal system between property rights and free speech with respect to physical property and with respect to intellectual property, that anyone who can monopolize any kind of forum has certain rights by virtue of their property ownership to really control what goes on that property, including speech. So this has happened in the real world in terms of shopping malls and company-owned towns where people have wanted to distribute leaflets on the premises, and the premises is owned by someone who doesn't want that kind of speech on that kind of premises. So there's always been a tension between property ownership and free speech. And in America, that plays out with the First Amendment and property ownership, and they're both very, very strong rights in the real world. It also historically plays out in traditional intellectual property. Copyright law has to strike a balance between giving people a property right in individual expression, but allowing others who want to speak and perhaps refer to or use some of that expression to do so, so to protect the public domain of information and ideas. Trademark law, which is the most closely aligned, obviously, to domain name law, has the same issue. To what extent do you allow a trademark holder to monopolize any other time anyone else can use their trademark? And I remember years ago when The Apprentice was a big TV show, Donald Trump was trying to trademark "you're fired," and no one else would be allowed to say "you're fired" because it belonged to him. And there's been crazy cases like that. So the first part of the title of the book is really trying to get at that interplay between free speech and property rights that has always existed in every legal system in the world. The second part of the title is the global real estate issue, and that's really trying to point to the fact that this is the first time, probably, the domain name system is probably the first example of where that historical tension between speech and property plays out globally on a global stage, because usually it plays out within the confines of a domestic legal system and a domestic constitution, and domestic courts deal with that balance. the domain name system raises this issue of really, well, who globally has the constitutional competence to resolve the issues between rights in the domain space that are of a property nature and rights in the domain space that are more of an expressive nature. And so they're the two things I'm trying to get at in the title.
All of these three areas, if we take them separately, internet domain names, trademark, and free speech, have competing policy concerns within them, and how we define what we trademark gets us into policy concerns about the interest of the consumer versus the monopoly power and so forth. And free speech, of course, is replete with the question of, well, what speech are we going to protect constitutionally, and what levels of protection are we going to afford certain types of speech? Domain names themselves don't seem, although they are policy issues, don't seem on their face particularly troublesome, and it doesn't, at least at first blush, appear to be something where you would think there would be a ton of conflict. And yet, in your writing and certainly in the book you're working on, you identify many places where domain name disputes arise. I guess as a foundational question, I'll ask you, what is the nature of domain name disputes generally? I mean, is there a unifying theme or problem that exists within the world of domain names that gives rise to so much litigation?
Well, I actually think the unifying theme is the thing that was simply never resolved back in the mid-1990s, and that is just what is the character of a domain name for law and policy purposes? Because there's at least three ways you could characterize a domain name, and which characterization you choose will impact on what follows from that in terms of balancing rights and interests in a domain name. So you could see a domain name as a simple address, just a simple addressing system created by contract between a registrant and a registrar, so to that extent maybe it has a contractual element to it as well. You could see it as a form of speech because it does use words and phrases, and then it becomes part of the lexicon, part of the public domain or the private domain of speech. Or you could see it, regardless of whether it involves a trademark or not, as a standalone property right. You could see it as an asset. And many, many people do. Domain name speculators from day one have regarded these things as valuable assets that can be traded online and more akin to a property right than anything else. And so the problem is that when we have a legal system that is usually premised on balancing interests between speech and expression and contract and doesn't really deal very much with addressing systems, but you have one asset that could be characterized under either of those headings, you get a lot of confusion. And an interesting thing that I had picked up back in the 1990s was that when domain names really first started to become noticed and become popular, the Network Solutions website, and Network Solutions was at that time the only registrar for the .com name, their FAQ, frequently asked questions website said around 1995, a domain name is your property that you own. And when these disputes started, that was quickly removed from the website, and that was as close as anyone came to a characterization of what a domain name is. Oh, well, it's not necessarily property, but that doesn't really tell us what it is. So I think that's really the root of the difficulty, that there's never been a clear characterization of this particular thing.
The the original architects of the internet, I'm confident, were not envisioning the spate of litigation that exists generally in e-commerce, and of course how could they have, given the vast technologies that have come to fore in the last several years that make this this network of computers such a powerful resource. With respect to the issues that you're focusing on here, one fundamental question I think that really arises from your discussion of what you're saying is whether domain names themselves should confer any rights at all. Especially given the fact that you've identified ICANN, the entity that's involved with this, as not having a policymaking function. That being the case, I mean, how do you view domain names from a rights perspective? I mean, should they confer any more rights than simply this is a name that you might be able to use as an IP address?
Well, I think that's also a very interesting question. I think the confusion arises because it's probably true to say that domain names really don't technically confer in and of themselves any rights greater than you have a contractual license to have a website under this domain name, provided that you're not infringing anyone else's rights. So that's basically what you get in your contract. The problem is that so many of the early domain name disputes involve trademarks, and people do have proprietary, or you might want to say quasi-proprietary, interests in trademarks. And so if a domain name in so many cases corresponds so closely to a trademark, then the issue of what rights you have in the domain name becomes very quickly conflated with the trademark question, and people start seeing domain names as trademarks or as akin to trademarks, or even if the domain name registrant doesn't particularly have strong rights in the domain name, someone does, because someone who has a trademark interest corresponding with the domain name can claim rights in the domain name as a result of their trademark interest.
We are talking with Professor Jackie Lipton at Case Western Reserve University School of Law, joining us by telephone from Cleveland here on Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM Stanford. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that Hearsay Culture is on KZSU, which is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that relies on donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. If you're interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to KZSU's webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless of whether you do that or not, and I certainly hope you consider it, I do hope that you continue to keep listening to KZSU and to Hearsay Culture. So Jackie, with this background, perhaps you could talk about this from the standpoint of the ultimate thesis of the book. I mean, we talked about that a bit, but if there's one argument or one point you're trying to bring to fore in this book to advance the discussion, what is it?
Well, I think my key point, and it really came out of the very first article that I wrote on domain names 4 or 5 years ago, is that the domain name regulation system has become skewed in favor of the protection of trademark interests, understandably, and that we now need to look at the system more broadly and create a broader lens and a broader range of options to look at the different kinds of domain name disputes that are arising and to resolve them more effectively than simply concentrating on trademark interests.
And with that in mind, I think it's important that we discuss a little bit the myriad ways that these disputes arise. Now, your book and your previous articles go through a number of examples, and perhaps for the benefit of the listeners, can you give us each of those examples and an example of each type of dispute?
And I'm probably going to miss something out mm-hmm. or blur something together, but as I went through and was teaching cyber law for the first few times and I was teaching the cases, it became evident that the paradigm category of domain name disputes is that cyber squatting category that appeared in the 1990s pretty early on when no one really knew what domain names were. And cyber squatters were clever people who figured, let's register a bunch of domain names corresponding with other people's trademarks so that as soon as the corporation realizes how valuable the domain name is, we can charge money to sell the name back to them. So that happened quite a lot in the mid to late 1990s, and that was fairly quickly stamped out with trademark law and with some new regulations that were implemented in 1999. So that is not something I'm particularly concentrating on in my work. I'm concentrating on other kinds of disputes. And there are a huge variety of them. There's situations where a registrant will register a domain name corresponding with a trademark, not to sell it to the owner, but to use it for some other commercial purpose, for example, a click farm, where the registrant is making money from hosting a website under the domain name that has a lot of click-through ads on it, and the registrant makes money when internet users click on those advertisements, but really has no intent to sell the name back to the trademark holder. Then you have situations where a domain name registrant registers a domain name corresponding with a trademark for expressive purposes, to criticise or complain about the trademark holder, or to maybe make fun of the trademark holder, to parody the trademark holder. So again, there's probably no intent to sell the name, and no intent to even make any commercial profit. It's simply an expressive use. Then you have categories of disputes that don't involve trademarks at all. So there's a whole lot of disputes that involve personal names in the domain space. And I actually break that down in my work into celebrity names, political names, and private individual names, because I think those disputes all raise different issues. I think celebrity names more often raise commercial concerns than the other classes of names. Political names often raise free speech concerns. Then you have some disputes that involve cultural and geographic indicators, like consider Ohio.com or Obama.com. Actually, Obama is the name of a city in Japan, as well as the name of the President of the United States, and that was originally registered to the city in Japan and now is registered to the President of the United States, but it doesn't involve a trademark at all. And finally, you have a very interesting category of cases that involve generic phrases that aren't trademarks, they're not personal names, and the one that springs to mind here is sex.com, which is very valuable because you can run a porn empire from it, but it's not a trademark. And this case, there was a case, a litigation in California that involved a conversion of that name, that a fraudulent person went to Network Solutions, the registrar, and said that he was authorised to take a transfer of the name when he wasn't. And he obtained the transfer and absconded south of the border, and the original registrant didn't have trademark rights and had to sue under California's conversion law, which is like the little brother of theft. It's a form of theft, effectively. And the one that I left out, I did leave out a trademark type of dispute, is the one where maybe you have two competing trademark holders with the same trademark in a word or phrase. So think of Delta Airlines and Delta Faucets. You can have people with the same trademark in a different product or geographic market, but as I said before, only one person can hold a domain name at the same time. So there's no real way of resolving that kind of dispute either. It's really first come, first served, unless there's bad faith in terms of the first registrant.
One of the areas that I focus on when I'm teaching cyber law is the issue of cyberspace exceptionalism. I mean, the question of whether new law is necessary to deal with these issues. And I guess as we think about ways to approach these types of litigation and balance the policies, I'll ask you that question. And with respect to domain name disputes, do you think that we need new law to deal with these issues, or can we use, borrow a phrase from Mark Lemley and Dan Burke, the policy levers that exist in current law to deal with these problems in a more expeditious fashion?
Well, I am such a cyberspace unexceptionalist turned exceptionalist over the years that I now lean more towards, gee, this is something new and we need to do something different. Although I do wonder if maybe there's a middle ground, because I think trademark law didn't do all that bad a job in terms of particularly dealing with cyber squatting. I think there was an uncomfortable fit between traditional trademark and infringement doctrines and what was going on with cyber squatters, but the courts dealt with it, and then Congress finessed it, and then ICANN came along and did the UDRP, which again is based on pretty much straightforward trademark concepts. So I think in that one area you could really be a cyberspace unexceptionalist. I think when it comes to these other kinds of issues, one might have to be more of an exceptionalist. One might have to say, well, this really is something different. because it does raise the policy levers that we've seen before. It does raise property, speech and contract, but it does it in such a different way, at such a global level, and just raising such different sets of stakeholders, perhaps. But I think probably the answer to that question is both. You have to be a little bit unexceptionalist and a little bit exceptionalist to deal with this problem.
In the international nature of disputes, of course, it has to be a major issue. And you've written about cultural issues and domain names that may not be reflected in the law. How does the international forum in which domain name registration occurs impact the decision-making process and litigation and how decisions are made?
Well, it's a very tricky question because initially, when Congress thought that really most of the disputes would be about traditional trademark-based cyber squatting, the US Congress put a provision into the Lanham Act, the trademark legislation, that basically allowed registrants of .com names, at least, to bring litigation in rem against a domain name. That means against the property right in the domain name without having to assert personal jurisdiction over the defendant. So if the defendant was in another country, the action could still be brought in the United States because most .com names were registered in the United States and the statute fixed the place of registration of the domain name as the appropriate place to hear the disputes. So that was an initial attempt by one government to deal with that. But soon that broke down partly because the domain name registration system was deregulated, and now the place of registration of even .com names is not always Herndon, Virginia, as it was back in the late 1990s. But additionally, as I said, many of these disputes aren't traditional cyber squatting disputes, and those in rem provisions are very clearly limited to that kind of dispute. So when you play it out on a global stage, the parties really have two choices. They can do the time-consuming and costly exercise of trying to convince a court. So a plaintiff can try and convince a court in the plaintiff's jurisdiction that, yes, this is the right place to hear the dispute and we should be applying the law of this place to the dispute and we should be asserting jurisdiction over this defendant in another country. And that's a really difficult thing to do. Or you can go to the Uniform Domain Name Dispute Resolution, or the UDRP, which is the contractual private mechanism for resolving disputes that ICANN implemented and oversees. So that's quick, cheap and easy, but again, it's very, very much focused on trademark principles. So if you don't have a trademark interest in the domain name, that's really pretty useless. But there is an interesting example that I give somewhere in the book of the popular actor Kevin Spacey, who was trying to bring an action against a cyber squatter with respect to KevinSpacey.com. And he failed to be able to do that under American law because the registrant was in Canada and the American court threw the case out on jurisdictional grounds. He then later succeeded under the UDRP, but that did mean he had to establish to the arbitrator's satisfaction that he had a trademark in his own personal name, which is not always the case.
The topic is trademark law and domain names. The book in progress is Global Real Property, Internet Domain Names, Trademark, and Free Speech. The guest and author, Professor Jackie Lipton from Case Western Reserve University School of Law. You know, when we talk about these international issues, and I think the example that you just gave me definitely brings this to fore, you've written about how the system itself of domain name registration has been dominated by the interest of Western countries. Does that issue play into the prevalence of the disputes that exist?
I'm sorry, I didn't see the end of that.
Oh, sorry. With respect to the Western domination of the domain name process because of its inception, does that issue play into the prevalence of litigation in this area?
I am not 100% sure about that. I suspect it probably does to an extent, although There are increasing numbers of cases. I'm aware of increasing, certainly, UDRP arbitrations in Asia-Pacific countries. I think the private contractual nature of that system for dispute resolution has been very enticing to people all over the world because it's very accessible. And even though it does embody traditional Western trademark principles, those principles are fairly well accepted as a matter of international law. The trademark system is fairly relatively well harmonised. So to the extent that you have a private, global, contractual, cheap, easy, accessible mechanism based on pretty much basic trademark principles, it's been fairly accessible and enticing to lots of countries. That doesn't mean it necessarily reflects everyone's cultural concerns, but to the extent that they might be a developing country and they're trying to protect their own trademarks in that country, or businessmen in that country are trying to protect their own personas in the domain space and are asserting trademarks in their personal names, I think to that extent this has become sort of global and reflective of what people want to do, but the effect of being able to really incorporate other kinds of cultural values in place names and tribal signifiers in different cultures, I don't think this is particularly useful. And it's not for lack of trying. I mean, the ICANN has asked the World Intellectual Property Organization to look at those issues and make recommendations in terms of the domain space, but they're very difficult issues. And at the moment, the World Intellectual Property Organization is still working on it.
Other than got to the next question I was going to ask, which is other than ICANN and WIPO, are there other international bodies or are there negotiations going on to address these concerns?
Well, WIPO has been charged by ICANN with making a lot of recommendations throughout this process, throughout the last 10 to 15 years, and it's an ongoing process. Of course, one of the main limitations with that is that WIPO is very concerned with protecting traditional intellectual property rights. They're the predominant stakeholders, and that's what WIPO understands. There are a bunch of other bodies that run UDRP arbitration services. So WIPO does run one of those services and hears about 70 to 80% of UDRP disputes, but there's several other fora that do that. One is the National Arbitration Forum, one is somewhere in Asia, and I can't remember the other one, and they change from time to time. They get registered and deregistered. So there's other constituents involved, but there are not, to the best of my knowledge, attempts at creating international treaties. The WTO GATT process isn't involved in this kind of thing. So, I mean, it is predominantly ICANN's baby, and to the extent that ICANN needs policy advice, they tend to go to WIPO.
So, Jackie, we have about 10 minutes left, and that's when I start asking the unfair questions. And the unfair questions generally boil down to, we don't have enough time to get into sufficient detail, but I ask them anyway. And so, you know, in the last 10 minutes that we have, I want to talk about some potential solutions that you've discussed and that you're thinking about to make the litigation operate more efficiently and perhaps to stem the litigation in the first place so that the issues that shouldn't be litigated aren't litigated and the policy values that you referred to are more accurately reflected. Again, as a top-level solution to the problem, you mentioned several in your writing, but what would be the top-level solution if there is one?
I don't think there's one. I think probably this is a piecemeal thing. Probably there's a variety of different solutions for different kinds of cases, which is why I ended up writing so many articles, because each article focused on one particular type of dispute and each book chapter focuses on one particular type of dispute.
Mm-hmm.
So my approach would be to sort of break it down in terms of things that are really about trademarks, things that are really about personal names, things that are really about generic terms, and things that are really about cultural terms, and then look at what are the appropriate ways of dealing with those particular issues. And there's obviously going to be overlap between those categories. So there'll be situations where someone is asserting a trademark and someone is asserting free speech, or someone's asserting a trademark and someone's asserting that there's a cultural significance to a particular term, like, for example, Amazon.com. So there's clearly going to be overlap, but I think my work has been bottom-up. It's kind of a bottom-up, pragmatic look at this, learning from past experiences what kinds of disputes there are, attacking each one individually, and if we can build up from that some overarching policy responses that could then lead us to perhaps a more unified system in the future.
From a structural standpoint, are you concerned that we would have different sets of rules for different types of disputes, which could ultimately lead to more litigation over those very rules, or am I overstating your argument too much?
You know, I think that's a risk, but I also think in terms of the things, the specific solutions I've tried to recommend in specific work I've done in the past, that if we make solutions for the different classes of disputes modelled as closely as possible on structures we already have, there's less concern and less confusion about the issue that you raise. So that if we take the case of competitions between multiple legitimate trademark owners or multiple legitimate personal name holders, and we model some kind of dispute resolution procedure on the UDRP that we already have, but instead of the result of the dispute being a transfer or cancellation order, it might be a domain name sharing order. So the processes are the same, the principles are fairly similar, but you perhaps get a different result if both parties have a legitimate interest. I've suggested the same thing with personal name cyber squatting, that we could again model something on the UDRP that is just a little broader, and instead of saying the complainant has to establish a trademark interest in the name, you could also say, well, the complainant just has to establish that the name is their personal name. And then if the other party is a cyber squatter, they should be able to get a transfer or cancellation order without necessarily having to prove a trademark and extend trademark law way outside where it was intended to go. So I think it's true that this is piecemeal and could lead to some confusion, but I think if you structure solutions to carefully track systems that are already in place, there would be a lot less confusion than otherwise there might be.
You know, the idea of the market solving all of our problems was increasingly popular, and perhaps it's now being questioned by more people in the wake of the financial meltdown that's existed over the last couple of years. But I do want to ask you in our remaining 6 minutes or so whether there are market solutions to these problems that would, again, address these issues, or is the market simply not the place for solving these problems?
Well, I mean, I think views vary on that, and it depends a little bit on what your background is and what you're comfortable with, how comfortable you are saying let the market take care of itself. I'm from the Anglo-Australian system, which tends, I'm constantly reminded by colleagues here, tends to like regulated solutions better than Americans tend to like regulated solutions. I do think it's possible for the market to take care of itself, and I know a lot of people have written in response to stuff I've written, you know, you're crazy, you're just saying that people should be robbed of the assets that they've rightfully registered, blah, blah, blah. And, I have sympathy for that point of view. That is clearly a viable solution, except for the fact that, you know, from my perspective, the internet is also a global communications medium. If you see the internet as something more than a commercial marketplace, and you see it as something that also gives disenfranchised people easy access to a global speech forum, then you might want to be more concerned that there are regulations that enable more people to have access to the domain names they need to present the views they want to present. And additionally, even within a marketplace, and again, it depends on how you feel about regulating commercial marketplaces, but what the internet allows that the physical world doesn't is almost a level playing field for the little guy and the big guy. And if the big guys get to dominate all of the domain names, so if between the big guys and the click farmers and the cyber squatters all of the good domain names are taken, then what does the little commercial guy do? They're already at a disadvantage like they were in the real world. So, you know, my personal leaning is towards some regulation, maybe not too heavy-handed, but I am sympathetic to people who say, well, you know, the market's working, let the market take care of itself, and maybe that's what we'll end up with anyway by default.
The issue, of course, also touches on, in the last few minutes that we have, whether this can be solved on a national level or an international level. And certainly all countries have to deal with how much encroachment they are going to allow on their own national laws as a result of treaties and international agreements. But this situation does seem like one that lends itself to an international solution. Is that something that you are looking for? And if so, how do you think nations will deal with having this significant issue of domain name registration perhaps removed to some degree from the purview of their national laws?
I think international regulation sounds really appealing, but when you get down to the pragmatics of it, it's very difficult, it's very slow, it's always such a compromise because of cultural and language barriers and who...
We are talking with Jackie Lipton here on Hearsay Culture on KZSU FM Stanford. We had a technical glitch there on Hearsay Culture, but we're back with Professor Jackie Lipton. So, Jackie, we were talking about international solutions, and you were expressing some skepticism that those bodies would ultimately solve the problem.
Yes, that's right. I was suggesting that really I'm talking about global problems, and I should want global solutions imposed by international treaty, but I'm skeptical of just about how pragmatic that is in terms of timing and interests and politics. And to the extent that anything done is international, it might be between ICANN and WIPO with the input of the various national constituencies, just drawing from the kinds of disputes arising and the more obvious solutions to those kinds of disputes. So as I suggested earlier, you could certainly create add-ons to a mechanism like the UDRP that deal with different kinds of disputes. And that is kind of an international approach, but it's more of a private international solution than a public international solution.
The book is Global Real Property, Internet Domain Names, Trademark, and Free Speech. So my crystal ball question for you, Jackie, is this one. Assuming that this problem is taken seriously, in 5 years from now, will we be seeing A, more or less litigation, and B, will the law be more fair and operate more efficiently? In other words, do you expect that we will see improvements in the law, or is this issue too difficult to tackle?
Well, I think whatever happens, we'll see more certainty and things settling down in the next 5 to 10 years. I do think that even within the current system, WIPO and the other arbitration services are becoming much better at delineating for everyone the boundaries of how the private system works in resolving disputes and what sorts of interests need to be better protected. What I would hope and what my work hopes to address is, could we streamline our approach? So, for example, not everything needs to become a trademark online, because I'm worried that everything will become trademark or other under the current system. If we keep the current system, I think we'll have less litigation and perhaps plenty of private dispute resolutions that are fine, but I would like to hopefully see a more streamlined approach that is better at categorizing the different types of interests we want to protect online.
The author is Jackie Lipton of Case Western Reserve University School of Law. The forthcoming book is Global Real Property, Internet Domain Names, Trademark, and Free Speech, to be published by Edward Elgar Publishers sometime in the first half of next year. Jackie, for those people that want to learn more about your work, are there any places that they can go?
Well, they can certainly look at my website, which is accessible from the Case Law School homepage, so that's www.law.case.edu, or do a Google search on me, and a ton of my articles will come up because I've posted drafts on SSRN and they're freely accessible. And as you said, the book will be out next year, and hopefully the publisher will do a good job of marketing it, and anyone interested can take a look.
Well, I look forward to having you back on the show in the future and discussing this issue in more detail. And I certainly thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture. I think it's been an enlightening discussion, and best of luck completing the manuscript.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jackie. And thank you for your patience with our technical glitch here towards the end of the show. For those of you that are interested, we have a number of new guests that are going to be coming up for the rest of the quarter. I'm looking forward to talking to, among others, Kazis Varnelis of Columbia University, author of the book The Infrastructural City. We're also going to be talking to Professor Alex Halivay of Quinnipiac University, the author of the book Search Engine Society. Geert Loving will be on the show discussing his book, Zero Comments. Professors Frank Pasquale and Danielle Citron will be on discussing the very interesting and challenging issue of fusion centers, as well as Professor Tarleton Gillespie will be on the show discussing his work in copyright. Professor Elizabeth Townsend Gard, along with a few of her students, will be on the show discussing their project, The Durationator. We will also have Professor Larry Downs discussing his work, and also Bill Patry of Google will be on the show discussing his new book in copyright. We have many other guests coming up, not only this quarter, but into the winter quarter, which is the quarter that I am now booking guests for. And so I did want to mention that if you have any suggestions for people that should be on the show or people I should know about, please email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. As always, you can listen to the show not only through KZSU, but also by going to Stanford Center for Internet Society's iTunes page in the iTunes search engine. You can also pick up the show through cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And lastly, you can go to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all the previous shows and also see the upcoming schedule. Thank you for listening today to Hearsay Culture. I hope you enjoyed the discussion. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and I will talk to you next week.